This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
Good morning, everybody. I am Glenda Geek in Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Jamie Jennings, and I'm out of breath because I just ran in. The builders here, they're here. And the thing is that the dogs have learned that when the builders are here, the builders give their food to the dogs. And they were throwing like chicken bones and stuff to the dogs. And so I have to like run out when the builders get here and make sure that they're not giving my dogs chicken wings. Anyway.
Yeah, not really good for dogs, chicken wings.
No, but the dogs love it. You're listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for September 11th, episode 2266, brought to you by horselovers.com. Good morning, horse world.
Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country.
I was lying in bed. All of a sudden, I heard what sounded like a plane or something coming extremely low, and then we just heard this shattering explosion. I ran up to the roof and confronted by this horror. There's a gaping hole. I can see the South Face, and there are flames. There are papers flying out of the windows, black flames. There are flames coming out of multiple floors.
Tomorrow, all the things were gone. I'd work for all
things
my life.
Things are really in chaos.
And I had to start again.
Well, it is 9/11 again, Jamie. You and I have done, well, we have done 10 9/11s now.
Oh, man.
Since we started this show. And, I'd like to say it gets easier over time, but it doesn't, and maybe it shouldn't. You know, that's it's one of those things that maybe shouldn't get easier over time. We did a special 9/11 tribute episode back in 2012 on the anniversary, and we're going to play that for you at the end of this show. We spent a long time talking about it on this show, where we were and what we were doing. And we had some people saying, I can't listen to that episode. So we're going to put it at the end. So we're going to have a normal show here today for you, and we're going to have a little fun. And then at the end of this episode, we're going to put our tribute. Maybe Jamie and I will recap where we were at that time, because that's what this tribute is about, is where horse people were at the time. So we'll do that at the end of the show, but our thoughts and prayers are out to all the families still. From that horrible day. But in the meantime, we're going to have a show like we normally do here on Horses in the Morning and have a little fun. I have a lot of birthdays for you today, Rachel Lauks.
What a crappy day to have a birthday,
I know.
Too. Sorry, guys.
I know. I didn't even think about that. You're right. We have a bunch of auditors with birthdays. Happy birthday to Rachel Lauks, Karina Grader, Tessa Heyman, and April Hardiman all have birthdays today. And I have another Daily Winnie, too. And this goes out to a woman who's 80 years of age. Her name is Sheila Richards, and she is in Idaho. And for the first time at the age of 80, she competed in her first show ever. She went to the Post Falls Equestrian Center Dressage and Hunter Jumper Show and riding her 25-year-old horse, an Arabian mare named Shaney. She competed in the dressage competition, and she earned the championship for the Centurion Division. The two together have to be over 100 years, and they reached 105. I think they were the only ones in it, to be honest. So they won that, and she said she hasn't showed a horse in 30 years. She's been trail riding, but she just started taking dressage lessons for fun and decided to enter the competition. So good for her.
Man, you know what? Yesterday was Chad's grandmother's birthday. Chad is in his 40s. His grandmother turned 102 yesterday.
What?
Yes. Come on. She had a birthday party.
She did the horse show. And everything?
I mean, you know, she's 102, but Chad called her last night and she knew who he was. So
is she one of those that when you ask her what the key to long life is, she says whiskey and cigarettes every day?
Oh, God, no. Oh. She is as opposite from that as possible.
Because it seems like every time they interview one of those women, it's always I have 3 whiskeys a day.
Not this one. Not clean living on this one. So it's funny because Glenn put some news in the story in the bottom of our show notes that we look at. And it was that a tappet colt sold at Keeneland for $2 million. And then another horse sold for $2 million. Both of these selling to Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum's Godolphin State Stables. And they put those in there. And then I realized, oh, no. He did better than that. Oil must be good right now. The money must be good because this is what happened a little bit later.
Stone Street bred and raised, a bay colt by Curlin and a bounding by Lonro, and the well-bred colt by the 2-time Horse of the Year Curlin, the sire of Grade 1 Stakes winner Vino Rosso this year, out of a champion mare, bounding the first foal out of that Grade 1 Stakes winner, and the colt's dam is a half-sister to one of the leading 3-year-old colts in Europe, that is Anthony Van Dyke, who was runner-up in the Irish Derby, came back to win the Epsom Derby since the catalog, giving trainer Aidan O'Brien his latest victory in the Epsom Derby. From that colt, here's that Curlin colt.
How about 2? Thank you. Now 300. Do you whatever 3? Do you whatever 3? How about 2 bid? 300 boys. Do you and now 3? How about 2 bid? 300 boys. Do you bid? 400. 3 hit on a 400 boy. Now you want 400. How about 3 bid? 400. Say do you bid? 4 men. At 3 and 4. Let's find 4. Easy 4. At 300.
Okay, stop. Okay. Because it goes on for another 8 minutes, I believe. Yeah, it just keeps going. So let's see what a yearling Curlin colt goes for.
All right, let's fast forward.
Fast forward like 8 minutes. Stone Street.
Do you whatever 2? Do you whatever 2? I want not to think about every little thing before you say no. 1 bid, now 2, get 2 bid, 2.
Four
He's
million.
Worth everything you pay for him. I got 4 million, 1. I'll give you a little bit more time before we sell him. 4 million, 100 bid, now you whatever 2. Do you whatever 2? I want not to think about every little thing before you say no. 4 million,
think about
1.
Everything before
4
you
million,
say yes.
2. 1, not 2. They're still talking and you're going to talk all day long. Bid to me right now. 4 million, 1. 4 million, 2. How about 1 or not 2? Do you whatever 2? Say do whatever 2. Got to go. 100 bid, now 2. 4 million, 1. That might break his back. 4 million, 1. 4 million, 2. Last chance to the back at 4 million, 2. At 1, not 2, do whatever 2. And whatever 2, so they're done. Thank you. 4 million, 1 and 4 million, 2 and 4 million, 100,000, 4 million, 2.5. Sold that big colt in the back for 4 million, 100. Hold the applause, please. Hold the applause for a moment. Let's get a couple of pictures. We'll take him outside. Ron, you look as...
Hold the applause so he doesn't freak the hell out.
Yeah, right? 4 million, 100,000 is what the Sheikh spent. I mean, if you... you're at an auction. And you're like, God, that's my dream horse. I want it so bad. It doesn't matter if you're bidding against him because he will outbid you.
Yeah.
Because he can.
Do you think, obviously he's not there, so one of his people's probably there. And do you think that he just says, I don't care, just buy these, whatever.
I want that one.
Yeah.
This one, I want number 274. Yeah. The Curlin colt. And then this one. I don't care what it costs.
Well, he bought
because
one
it doesn't
for
matter.
Two and a half. He had the top three. He bought the one for $2.5 million and one for $2 million. It's like, in one sale. And
oh
he doesn't
God.
Seem to win a lot of races, does he? I mean, we're not always hearing about his horses winning.
They've done well, but not that well. I mean, again, you know, how do you make $1 billion with horses? Spend $10 billion. And yeah. That's how you do it.
I guess when you have $100 billion, you know, $4 million doesn't really matter that much.
That's peanuts.
Yeah.
Peanuts. But anyway, congratulations.
That's crazy. Yeah, that's just crazy. So do you want to do what we have coming up on today's show? We didn't say that because Jennifer's not here. So we have coming up on today's show a little bit later in the show, this really cool event, the Riding of the Marches that happens over in Scotland. And it involves 300 riders that start in the countryside and end in the middle of Edinburgh, riding down the Royal Mile of Edinburgh, which is this most beautiful cobblestone street surrounded by 1,000-year-old buildings. And we were just was there actually, and but they it's this very unique event, and we have the directors and the vice chairman coming on today to talk to us about how this got started, and how crazy it is to ride your horse down the hill in Edinburgh. So we'll talk about that today. Also, we have coming up, as I said, the 9/11 tribute, and I think Jamie has some wacky news.
Okay, so wacky news. It's just, this is just really hardcore sad news right here, is that there's a couple and they're sitting in their, you know, they're just hanging out in the kitchen, looking out the window, having some coffee. Their names are Janie and Jim Black, and they're in Aptos, California. And they see a beautiful Mercedes slowly coming down the street. And then they realize it's rolling backwards down the street. It's rolling backwards down the street towards their house. It's rolling backwards down the street up onto their lawn and hits their trash cans and then runs up onto their retaining wall. And they're like, oh my God, we need to run outside and see if the driver is okay. I wish I could show you the picture of the driver, because they ran outside to examine the damage, check on the driver, and they look in the front seat and there's Duke. Duke is in the car. Duke is a dog, and Duke has been left in the car when the owners ran back in the house to get something.
Put it in reverse.
Duke had a leash attached, and he jumped from the front to the back, to the front to the back, and somehow Duke's leash got wrapped around the gear shift, pulled it into neutral, and then he began rolling down the street. Again, nobody is hurt. The car is fine. I mean, you got a little damage. The retaining wall will be set back up. The trash cans took the brunt of it. They said Janie and Jim Black said the trash cans will not recover. They've seen better days. But Duke is okay.
And was Duke's his driver's license privileges were revoked, I assume?
I am sure. You know what's funny is Duke looks very pleased.
Okay, I bet he does.
He's very happy with himself. He's like, I heard those articles that you're not allowed to leave dogs in the car, and I'm going to do something about it. So Duke did something.
And they probably thought, well, I'm going to leave him in the car with the car running and the air conditioner on. They did the right thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not? So way to go, Duke. This beautiful Mercedes has now been crashed.
That's funny.
Next.
I'm sorry.
Oh, bless her heart. There's a woman in Oregon. Her name is Lauren Taylor. And it was last Sunday, and she walked into her house after coming home, and she sees something in her living room. And it is a giant mountain lion. Okay. In her living room, somebody in her house, she had housemates, somebody left the back door open, and a mountain lion came in the house. And it's just hanging out in their living room. She's like, oh God. So Taylor's housemate noticed the animal, screamed, and the lion jumped and ran behind the couch. And she's basically worked in wildlife rescue. And now this is where it gets silly. She practices energy healing, and she knew they'd have to give the cat a lot of space and remain calm to encourage the giant lion to leave safely. So she backed slowly out of the house, breathing and keeping her energy core intact. And she's so relaxed, and she backs out of the house, closes the door, and the mountain lion jumps up on the couch and goes to sleep.
She put the mountain lion right to sleep with her energy healing.
Right to sleep with her energy healing. She said, Taylor wrote on Facebook, once the energy shifted, even though she was frightened and agitated and determined to exit, once the energy shifted, she calmed right down and went to sleep. And this crazy lady sat outside of her living room for 6 hours watching the mountain lion.
She didn't call anybody?
No, she just let it sleep on the couch for 6 hours. She said she used mountain lion body language to blink at it and let
to
it.
To blink at it?
She blinked at it. She said, I gazed lovingly, then blinked hard, and then she backed down, and then she went to sleep on their living room couch for 6 hours. And she said, we needed to eventually prompt her to leave without alarming her so much that she panicked. So they opened a bunch of doors and they went outside and started a drum circle.
No, which, you're making this up.
I am not making it up. They started lightly tapping the drum.
Did you say Oregon or Washington?
It's Oregon.
Yeah, okay.
And then as they started tapping the drums, they roused her. They said it looked like she knew just what to do. She walked through the open door, through the yard, across the creek, and through the empty field and disappeared.
Yeah, because she woke up to all this drumming and went, these crazy people, I'm out of here.
I'm not hanging out with these nutty people. So, they think the mountain lion came up to drink from the fountain in the backyard and then came on in. She said it was a very humbling experience, one that she's not soon to forget.
Yeah. Normally, I would say alcohol involved, but I would say probably pot involved in this entire day and a lot of it. Oh, my God. That's crazy.
Well, I can't help it. I love Taylor Swift. I do. I love her music. I love her. I love everything that she stands for. I think she's beautiful and she's fantastic. I've met her. She's very tall and she's lovely.
Just and don't break up with her because you'll get a song.
Don't date that girl. But point is, she's loved by a lot of people and she's loved by a whole lot of people. One, who shall remain named, well, his name is Richard, and he loves her so much that he decided to spend some time with her in her home. And he broke into her house and decided he was just going to hang out. Well, she's no stranger to having people stalk her and break in her house.
Is this her house in Rhode Island?
No, I think this one is
on beach.
Yes, beachfront,
yeah.
Rhode Island.
I've seen that house. Yeah.
Yeah, so she's the guy's from New Jersey. He makes the trip out, and the police come and they go in to arrest him. And he's barefoot. He doesn't have any shoes on. And they're like, okay, you just broke into Taylor Swift's house. Why are you barefoot? And he was like, it's not polite to wear shoes in Taylor Swift's house. So he gets arrested without his shoes on. His shoes are at the front door because even though he's crazy enough to break into her house,
he wasn't the husband of the mountain lion lady, was he?
He still removed his shoes. So way to go, dude.
How did he get in the house? There's security. They'll even kick you. She has beach in front of that. I've been there. She has beach in front of that. And there's security guards that will kick you off her beach whether she's there or not.
Did you take your shoes off before you went to arrest?
I didn't go. Yeah. No, I kept my sneakers on. I didn't get arrested though. Maybe I ran faster.
One more. Well, congratulations to Mangayama Yaramati because she opted for in vitro fertilization after years of being unable to conceive. And Mangayama Yaramati lives in India. And congratulations because last week she gave birth via C-section and is currently in intensive care to come out of the stress of giving birth, doctor said. Both mother and infants are healthy, no complications whatsoever, which is shocking. Considering Mangayama Yaramati, are you sitting down, Glenn?
Okay.
She's 74 years old.
What?
74 years old. Uma Shankar, the doctor who delivered the babies, told the Washington Post, yes, she is 74, according to the provided birth certificate. They went to say her husband, Sitarama Rajaharo, told the Times of India, we are the happiest couple on earth today. We have our own children. That Yaramati said that not having a child was a source of guilt, and people looked at her with accusing eyes as if she had committed a sin. So by God, she got herself pregnant. And at 74 is the new mother of twins.
You thought it was tough at 40.
There's so much wrong with this. The pregnancy has raised alarm among local doctors.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because it's a debatable issue, letting a woman of that age carry children to term when they are 74 years old. So congratulations
Maybe
to the new parents.
Maybe she'll be like Chad's grandmother and she'll still be around for the weddings and the grandchildren.
I mean, she could be 102, yeah. And this is India, so they could live, you know, to 300. It could be no problem. So yeah, congratulations, 74 years old, giving birth to twins. I thought at 40 I was going to die with one baby. So way to go, Mangayama.
And well done with the names, by the way. Well done.
You're welcome.
Hey, I have one. I'm surprised you didn't do this story. So Curtis Whitson decided to take his girlfriend and his 13-year-old child hiking in California. So they went hiking and into the wilderness of California, and he had been to this place that was near a waterfall several times, but it was kind of a tough hike in, and usually there's ropes involved and all this stuff. Well, they did 2.5 days of hiking with 50-pound packs. By the way, your packs are way too heavy. And he ended up at the waterfall. But the problem was, apparently when they got in, they couldn't get back out because the rope that is used to get back out of the area they were in, I don't know the exact details of this, wasn't there anymore, had broke. So he was stuck. He and the family were stuck there at the waterfall. So he couldn't get out. They tried climbing multiple routes and kept getting to dead ends, and they just were stuck. Again, I don't know why they got in and couldn't get out, but they were stuck. So he decided to take a water bottle, and his girlfriend was a bartender, and she had some bar slips, you know, some receipts. So they took a pen and wrote that they needed help on the bar slips. They took it, stuffed it in a water bottle, wrote help on the scratched help into the outside of the water bottle, and sent it down the waterfall. Well, I'll be darned if about a half an hour later, two hikers didn't see this bottle, picked it up out of the stream, saw the SOS and the help, read the thing, hiked their way back to a campground to contact California Highway Patrol. They sent out a helicopter. By then, it was about midnight. The helicopter got over them and announced, "We'll be back to rescue you in the morning. We know you're there." And the helicopter went back the next morning. They camped out. Helicopter went back the next morning and rescued them about 10 o'clock.
That is crazy.
I mean, what are the chances of somebody finding the bottle?
That's one of those things, like, first of all, your pack is too big if you've got bar receipts that are in your pack. Yeah. You should have probably emptied out your purse.
Yeah.
But it's a good thing you didn't, I guess, because they emptied out their purse. They wouldn't have had the bar receipts to write a note. But what happened is, where is this? California?
It's California, yeah.
The people who saw the bottle, they're like, how dare somebody litter?
Litter.
And they grabbed it.
That's right. That's probably exactly what happened. Yeah, wow. So, I mean, they got lucky. The guy admits, we got lucky that they found the bottle. Of course, they didn't have any cell service because, you know, nowhere in this country seems to have cell service. So, thank God they... And these people had to hike. Apparently, the backpackers had to hike a good distance to get to a place where they could notify the authorities. They had to get to this campground because they didn't have cell service either.
That is crazy.
But the hikers left, so they don't know who they are. They just apparently, you know, did their thing and alerted the authorities and then hiked on out. So
wow,
that was a cool. I just thought that was a fun story.
That's fantastic. Fantastic. Good job.
Well,
way to go.
There's a, you know, Horse and Hound has been great lately for posting some great lists. And they did one, the 8 things we unquestionably do, even though thinking about it, it's a bit weird. So you want to hear the 8 things? Now there's more than 8.
Horse people?
Yeah, horse people. I would venture to say that as a horse husband, there's 1,000 things you all do that are a bit weird. But anyway.
Oh, I do minimum 15 a day.
So braiding manes to the right. Apparently, do you know where that came from?
You mean trying to train the mane all to be on the right side?
Yeah. Why the right?
No, I don't know. I don't know. I would have thought left because you didn't want, when you're swinging a rope, you don't want the horse's mane to impede the rope. Not that I'm swinging a rope, which is why I don't do this weird behavior. But why do people braid the manes to the right?
Well, what they say here is that Googling doesn't reveal any context apart from it was an evil practice invented in the 19th century to torture grooms. Which they say doesn't sound very historically accurate. They don't know why that. Apparently, it was tradition. It's been on the right, staying on the right.
Is that like hunter? Because I've worked with people that were like that, but it never made sense to me.
It probably dates back to the fox hunting days, doesn't it? You know, way, way back, a couple hundred years ago in England, I would assume. I don't know.
If anybody can tell us why you braid a horse's mane to the right, please message me.
Yes, other than the torture grooms. Mounting from the left.
Oh, I know this one.
Well, okay, you tell me.
Okay, so you mount from the left. And again, I don't practice this. I practice both sides because I don't have a sword, but because the knights always had a sword in their pants, you know, they hang off to the left because they draw the scabbard with their right, draw it out of the scabbard with their right hand, whoosh, and up. So that's why you always mounted from the left.
That is correct. Ding, ding, ding. Look at you.
Yes. But again, you know, people always say you always have to mount from the left. And that is true when you're getting on a strange horse, because most horses are desensitized to the left. But you know what? Practice it to the right. And then I remember mounting a horse from a ride at a boarding stable. They were like, you're not supposed to mount from the right. I'm like, it's my horse. Yeah. But there's a reason you mount from the left. Really? What is that? Well, because when ancient times when they had swords, and I'm like, do you see a sword?
I could let you borrow one if you really need one.
Because it is amazing how odd it feels mounting from the opposite side. I want everybody to be safe and try it. And you will see how weird it is to put your right foot in the stirrup first and hop over the back of the horse. It's so bizarre.
And, you know, Karen strange. Talks about that in the endurance episode. One of the first lessons she ever gave years ago when she started doing that was, you, as endurance riders, you have to learn to mount from the right and the left, because if you, you know, if you're, the cliff is on one side and you have to jump off and you only have one side to get on, and it's the side you're used to, and it's a drop that's 1,000 feet. You better freaking learn how to get on from the other side.
I was thinking, you know, what if I'm on the edge of a cliff and I have to mount from the offside? Then I definitely, no, I didn't think that.
Apparently with endurance riders, that is a thing.
So. I'm not in Tevis next year. So,
hair nets. We willingly pull on these truly hideous items in order to look neat and tidy for competing. So,
You know what? Ever since, so I went to get a haircut right before we went to London. There's a lady that cuts hair in our neighborhood, and she's like a little studio outside her house. And I go to get my hair cut. I'm like, it's just a trim, you know, it's so heavy. I just want to trim. And she's like, okay. And she cuts down the front and razor blades across the front. And I was like, oh my God, did you just give me bangs? I haven't talked about this because she might listen. But she gave me bangs. I think enough time has passed. And she's like, oh my God, you're going to love them. No. They're terrible. Do you know what I have to do every time I ride out, Glenn?
1980s bangs, like 1980s style?
I haven't had bangs since I was like 11.
Yeah, 1980s, okay? Right?
Yeah, pretty much. And now I have bangs. And you know how hard it is to ride your horse with bangs?
Is that why I haven't seen many selfies of you lately?
There's no, I don't do selfies because I don't look that good close up. So, but I would like to point out, when you have bangs, you have to wear a hairnet. And I found the best hairnet in the world. It's called the No Knot Hairnet. And we're going to have the creators of them on. I just sent Jennifer all the information because I have to wear a hairnet. It's called the No Knot Hairnet.
Okay.
NOKNOT hairnet. And I just found the inventor of them, and they're the greatest hairnets of all time. And if you ever thought, why would I pay $10 for a hairnet? Here's why. It's awesome. So at any rate, that is
what I
use now.
Do you know why they originally started wearing hairnets?
Because of bangs, Glenn.
No.
Because you can't see.
No, well, that might be a part of it. But the other than vanity and looking good and all that, they wore them. Apparently, it was a safety thing. If you fell off, that way your horse didn't step on your hair.
Oh, that's stupid.
He caught on your hair. That's what they say here. I don't know.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. Another one, brown tack for hunting and showing. Like, why did brown?
Why brown? I mean, Everything used to be brown, though, when I was growing up, and now there's black and brown and everything. So now you have to have a couple of everything. So why?
I don't know, because traditionally black tack was used for driving horses back then. So
brown is for hunting.
Yeah.
Use black tack for hunting.
Yeah.
Why?
So garter straps. Was there a reason for garter straps? Apparently, they had a functional use, and it was to help stop the breeches from riding up the legs. And I remember that from the old days.
Like to hold up your pantyhose, like under your sexy clothes, like those kind of garter?
It was to help stop the breeches from riding up. So you would put them, you know, that's what they were used for originally. Stock tie, you know, I think that was just a hunting thing. That's where that came from. Beige, white jodhpurs. Well, we've had this discussion before about why anybody wears white anything around a horse.
I'll tell you what, I will not wear white on cross country. No way. And I see girls doing it all the time. And you know what somebody told me? One of my instructors, who was like a Rolex rider when I was in my teens, she was like, You wear white on breeches? You wear white breeches on cross country? You're going to get them dirty. You're asking to get them dirty. So it means basically like asking to hit the dirt. You're asking to get those things dirty. So I always will swap, even like on a one day. I'm like, I got to change my pants. I'm a crazy person when it comes to that. But it's the same thing with like, don't ever, ever, ladies, if you're listening, gentlemen, don't ever set your helmet on the ground. Ever, ever, ever. Do you know why? Because you never want your helmet to touch the ground. You're asking for it. Same thing with white breeches. You're asking to get your butt dirty.
I would I'm going to get a lot of negative email. I shouldn't do it because I'd back the truck over it.
That's true.
That's what would happen to me.
Those are just some of the weird, quirky things that I do on a daily basis. Go ahead.
We all have our quirks. We should post that. What's your quirk? We should post that on our Horse in the Morning.
Oh, that's a good idea.
All right. So let's go to our guests, and we'll talk about horse lovers after our guests. We're going to be calling Scotland right now. Actually, Jennifer and I were just here about a month ago, and we were where this event takes place. It's called the Edinburgh Riding of the Marches. And 300 horses get together, 20,000 spectators, and it's quite an event. And we're going to learn about that right now. So as I said, we spent a little bit of time. We spent a week, my wife and I, in Edinburgh a month ago. We went to see the tattoo, and we saw a lot of interesting acts that come in for a festival there. And there is something that they told us you have to get somebody on to talk about. It happens in another month. So we have Sam Lockhart here. She's the Vice Chair, Marketing and Press Officer for the Edinburgh March Riding Association. And we also have Stuart with us. He is one of the directors of the event as well. And of course, we're talking about the Edinburgh Riding of the Marches. Hi, Sam. Hi, Stuart.
Hello. Good afternoon from Edinburgh.
So, Sam, tell us what is this? By the way, Edinburgh was one of the favorite cities I've ever visited in my life. It was so cool. Now, the Fringe Festival made it interesting, really interesting, but the tattoo was one of the best shows and concerts I've ever seen. It was just incredible. And Sam, it did not rain the night we saw it.
Well, you're very lucky. I think it rained almost every night of the festival, so you were very blessed.
Yeah, we were. It was absolutely beautiful. Yeah. I mean, it was stunningly beautiful that night. And of course, with the fireworks over the castle and the whole thing, it was just incredible. So
when you live in Scotland, you do have to get used to the weather.
Yeah, we learned that the rest of the days. We've got a lot of use out of our raincoats. So what is the Ride of the Marches?
Okay, so the Edinburgh Riding of the Marches is actually a very, very old custom dating back hundreds of years, which was the process of inspecting the common land. That's the land that belonged to the people. To check from raiders and encroachment, and to make sure that the gentry were not trying to steal the common land back from the common people.
Okay, so they would would ride out in a group to do that?
Yes, correct. So tradition had it that the Lord Provost of the city of Edinburgh, that is like the Lord Mayor of the town, would command all those who had a horse or had access to a horse to meet at his house at 11 o'clock in the morning on one particular date of the year. And from there, they would proceed on the ride of the march land. And this was a huge outing that took place. And if you didn't take part and you were discovered that you tried to avoid to take part, you were actually fined. So in those days, obviously, there were a lot of opportunities for the baddies to get themselves into position to try and take back the land. So it wouldn't have been quite as polite as it is nowadays. You would have had a few situations where there would have been probably a few, what they call in Scotland, stramashes, sort of altercations. So you can imagine there would have been quite a lot of noise and shouting, a lot of checking and measuring, and quite a formal procedure. I'm sure that not everybody came back in one piece.
And judging by my experience in Scotland, I'm sure there was no alcohol involved in this entire day.
I doubt it very much.
Stuart.
My colleague Stuart actually is, he has been involved in this event for nearly the full 10 years. This custom was brought back into revival in 2009. So he'll be able to give some really cool details on the history of this custom.
So, Stuart, what nowadays, obviously, they started this and it was, God, you get 300 horses there from what I read.
Yeah, we do now. Yeah, we started, as Sam's depicted there, sort of the earliest date we have of arriving the marches is within the region of, I think it's 1579 is the date that appears on our badge. But there are some records that go back to 1494. But what happened is the arriving the marches right across Scotland was mainly disbanded around about 1718, which was a number of years later. That was about 300 years ago, as well, a bit more than that now, I think. But basically what happened was there was a long, long time when particularly in the big cities like Edinburgh, like ours, when no riding of the marches took place. But we revived it in 2009. So I was part of the original team. There were four men who started it, and then I joined on the year after. And we can now get up to 280 horses who will come out and ride the bounds of Edinburgh. Yeah.
So now, Sam, they start outside of town, right?
Yes, correct. So obviously these days, the bounds of the city of Edinburgh are very much more built up than in the olden times. So what we do is we get very kind permission from lots of landowners that reside on the sort of inner outskirts of the city of Edinburgh. They kind of sit within the ring road that goes around the city of Edinburgh, and they very kindly grant us access to parts of their land where we can carry out the reenactment of the riding of the boundaries. And this means that all the horses and riders can have a really good charge about in the morning and get some energy off. Because as you can imagine, in order to get 280 or so horses calmly and quietly up the Royal Mile, on those cobbled streets with sort of crowds of what we reckon are sort of 20 to 25,000 people watching, you really want them to have the edge taken off by then. And this route is a 26-mile route in total. So on their final mile up the Royal Mile, they've had a really good ride in the morning. All the horses are tired. The riders are getting there. Pretty tired as well, and it really is a much more peaceful end to the day.
To give people an idea who haven't been to Edinburgh, it's not a flat mm-hmm. city. So
no.
It starts, the Royal Mile starts at the Edinburgh Castle at the top of the hill, which is just absolutely spectacular, and then ends mm-hmm. at the palace at the bottom of the hill. And it's a hill, and it's cobblestone. It's funny, my wife and I, when we were there, we said, if this gets wet, how did horses ever pull a carriage or ride up? Mm-hmm. Wet, it must be slippery.
Yes, it can get slippery. In actual fact, because the horses are only going at a walking pace and they're actually going up the Royal Mile rather than down it, it's actually, there's minimal problems with horses going up. In the olden days, actually, fairly early on, studs were incorporated into the bottom of horses' shoes, and that would stop them slipping quite so much. And also in the olden days, there was probably a lot more dirt and grit scattered about the old town of Edinburgh. So these horses are very firm-footed. These traditions actually are carried out in many of the Scottish borders towns. So these horses that take part in the Edinburgh Ride have been doing these kind of events pretty much every weekend since April, every single year. This is the last ride out of the season, and these horses are fit as anything.
Who rides, Stuart? All kinds of people from all kinds of disciplines, or?
Yeah, lots of different people. I mean, you've got your sort of stalwart common riders, if you like. So these are the people who do, as many common rides as they can throughout the year. Because of course, this is a tradition that's done all over Scotland in different towns, and I think in the region of 29 to 30 riding towns. So from, as Sam was saying there, from May sort of onwards to September is when the season takes place. So you've got your sort of stalwart common riders. These are people who largely have their own horses or they use stable horses, and they'll do lots and lots of rides throughout the year. And then you have, we also have people with their own private horses who, maybe not do much common riding, but are really experienced horse people. So they might just fancy it as an extracurricular activity. And then you get all the visiting principals and our principal party, which is you know, all the other principals from other towns will come and do our ride. And then our principal party has the captain and the lass, which is the Edinburgh captain, Conor Geddes, and the lass, Liz Hessel. They'll be leading the ride this year. And then, of course, you get the adrenaline junkies. So you get the people who, you know, maybe never even done anything like this before, but you know, they see it, they quite fancy it, they buy a place, and then they get hacking and learn how to ride in a short period of time, and then they just do maybe their first ever common ride, which is also excellent. And we're really proud to say that we've got a number of young people taking part this year as well. There's over 20 under 16s taking part this year, which is absolutely excellent. So it's really a cross section. You know, our youngest rider will maybe be 12, but our oldest rider will maybe be 80. You know, so it's quite a diverse section right across the board.
Hey Jamie, I see a road trip. We should. Jennifer wants to because you can rent horses for this. She wants to go over and do it.
Yeah.
Are you in, Jamie?
Yeah.
You think you can?
I already left.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, actually, it is one of the most unique experiences. If you love horse riding and you love history, it is, as I say, it's a really long, grueling day. But really, time flies. You know, these horses know what they're doing. As I say, they do it throughout the season. You have to be reasonably fit and have a reasonably good riding ability, because obviously most of the morning you are traveling at a canter or a gallop. But it really is one of the most fantastic experiences. We actually had some visitors from an international riding holiday company from Australia come over last year and take part. So they had two film crew and their third person was riding. And let's just say most of her GoPro footage could not be repeated with her sound, because her experience that was verbalized was so dramatic in her enjoyment that they had to cut a few words out.
They are Australian after all.
Yeah.
So this is so cool. You know, I encourage everybody, we'll post a video on our Horses in the Morning page that you guys did.
Sure.
It really shows how fast you go, and then it shows you coming into town. It's also a festival. There are bands. Of course, there's bagpipes. You're in Scotland. There has to be. It's required.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and it looks like, my guess is, there's a party after. That'd be my guess.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a great party afterwards. I mean, these riders that ride, the Scottish riders that ride these events, are some of the hardest riders I have ever come across. And they can survive this day and still have enough energy to party on into the very, very small hours of the night.
Welcome to Scotland, everybody.
Yeah.
So one of the other things, too, that's interesting in Scotland, and maybe, Stuart, you can answer this. When we were there, we yep. found out when you ride in the countryside, it's not like here. Basically, all you can ride on anybody's property. Is that what I understand?
Ah, well, you've asked the right person. Yeah. I mean, we might get a bit boring here, but I'll try and keep it as chirpy as I can. I mean, there is legislation that in Scotland that we've got what's called a right of access in Scotland to most land. We still have private property. You can't just, you know, walk into someone's house or into their garden or something like that. But in terms of our open countryside, we've got what's called the Land Reform Act, which gives us reasonable access to most places. But unfortunately, we don't fall into that category because we're an organised event, and because we're bringing 300 horses over private land, we obviously have to get permission from the landowner. It wouldn't be reasonable for us to bring or gallop 300 horses over a farmer's field. I'm not sure. I think he would be able to take us to court if we caused damage. So.
Yeah, I mean that would trash a cornfield for sure. So.
Absolutely.
That's right. Well, I mean, all the fields that we come over are obviously crops. They're all the crops being brought in, so it's all stubble fields. But we still have to seek permission. Just that. But I mean, strictly speaking, you know, in Scotland, if you're walking your dog, you can walk across a cut field and you wouldn't be committing an offence. So there you go. Yeah, we're a wee bit more sort of because we have such beautiful countryside, and that's part of the game. You know, that's part of living in Scotland. So
yeah, you do have beautiful countryside. There's no question about that. Definitely. Yeah. Well, I would recommend everybody visit Scotland. Definitely visit Edinburgh. If you can go see the Royal Tattoo in August and see the Fringe Festival, do that too. Yeah. Talk about two opposite things, by the way. The Royal Tattoo and the Fringe Festival couldn't be more opposite. It was fun, though. We had a great time. So thank you guys for joining us. It's Edinburgh Riding of the Marches.com is where you can find it. We'll post a link to the YouTube video on our page as well. Thanks, guys, and good luck. It's this weekend, so have fun.
Yes, it is. Thank you so much. Lovely to talk to you. Okay.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. I think we can make it by next year.
I don't know if you watch the video, but they do go like a bat out of hell. They're flying across those fields. And I can understand wanting to wear the horses out before they get to town. That is an uphill. It is a hike. And it's a royal mile. It's a mile from the palace to the castle, and it's uphill, and it's all cobblestones. You know, think about back then, even in London, they had cobblestones everywhere. Boston has cobblestones everywhere. You had those carriages being pulled by horses on cobblestones. It couldn't have been easy.
Doesn't it make you crazy watching movies where people canter along cobblestones? And I'm like, oh,
yeah,
God.
Don't do that.
Okay.
I realize they put studs or borium or something on their feet, but still. It made me cringe, that's for sure. And it is always raining there. That is true. So it's a fun event. It looks like a blast. And I know our listeners over there have done it a couple times and really love doing it. So we thought we'd share. One of the requests we had from the auditors was, can we find out more about international events that are happening? So this is the first one. We're going to start taking a look at more international events that are happening.
So I did post what people do that is quirky besides me not letting my helmet touch the ground and not wearing white breeches on cross country.
Yeah.
Kayla says she always gives the horse a pat on the forehead before and after she rides, no matter what, she says. No matter what. She also doesn't clip whiskers anymore, which I love. Your wife chimed in. Where is she right now?
In her office, I think. Supposed to be doing accounting, actually.
She is not. She's on Facebook. And she says that one thing that she says, when we go away, I cannot tack up the horses. Can't tack up the horses until I've hung their water buckets up on the trailer. Can't go to the secretary stands. Can't go to the port-a-loo. Gotta hang the buckets.
Oh, that is absolutely correct. Whenever we go anywhere, first thing she does, get the horses out, hang the buckets.
Rhonda's got a good one, and this is I have a beautiful wedding ring that is currently like in storage because I wear a silicone wedding ring because I'm a paranoid freak about getting my finger caught in the reins. And she says she will not wear her rings to the barn because smart she has a move. Weird fear of getting her finger stepped on and the ring being squashed. That's more terror. Thank you.
No, we've actually read stories over the years of people who've lost their fingers because their ring gets caught in something.
Well, I had a student in a jump lesson recently married, happily sporting a ring, not wearing any gloves or anything. And she jumped a fence and the horse just kind of like stumbled a little bit, I guess, before the jump. And she got her finger caught in the ring and a spiral fracture of that finger.
I know a lot of horsewomen will not wear rings at the barn. Smart move.
Yes. Jessica says, God, this makes me sound like I'm 16, but I always take like a million selfies with my horse and pics of him when I'm there, even though all my pictures look basically the same because we're in the same arena, Jessica, on the same trail, minus my clothes or his saddle pad being different. Like, that's the only difference. Yes. She said that probably sounds more like a first world problem. Jesse says, I never realized it before, but after explaining how to train something, I realize the weird voice cues I use, like hang out here is what she says to a horse that she's ground tying. She's like, hey, hang out here.
Just to hang out here.
How's that work for you? And a lot.
Drinks are in the bucket.
Yeah, exactly. Ease it down means back out of the trailer slowly. Teresa says, I'm the same way about my helmet. I don't have any real quirks. Yes, you do. You just can't think of any right now. But I'm annoyingly type A and OCD, so everything in my tack locker has to be exactly in its place. This is my poor boyfriend will try to help me put stuff away, and I end up moving everything afterwards. So it's in there right. She says, I'm horrible. Oh, God.
We do the same thing when we load the dishwasher. Uh-huh. Is that what you were going to say?
Yes, because my mother-in-law, by God, I learned quickly, do not help her in the kitchen, because whatever you do, she will undo and redo.
I load the dishes one way. Jennifer comes in and actually rearranges them.
Well, that's because you men have a real problem with spatial.
And then I'll come back and rearrange it again. So by the time the dishes are actually washed, they've probably been rearranged about five times.
You could probably have just left it the first
time. Or washed them by hand and been done with it by the time
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, horselovers.com's having a sale. Big surprise, right? Shire's products are on sale right now. They got blankets, they got jackets, they got breeches, up to 95% off. You heard that right. So they have breeches that were originally $110, marked down to $53. That's the Kensington breeches, which I know a lot of people do wear those. They have saddle pads, the Shire's Performance fleece line saddle pads, which are really popular, marked down 52% to $43. And that's the fleece lined ones. They have bits. They have four pages of Shire stuff marked down. Now, these sales don't last long, so you're going to want to head over there right away. But they do have the Shire's Dressage Competition saddle pads, which are really popular. They're regularly $40, marked down to $20. They always get great reviews.
Also, really, those Justin Ladies Windshire field boots.
Oh, yeah, and I feel like we've done that. We talked about them. You bought some.
I bought some.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love them. They're so soft. I didn't really have to break them in. They fit this like grippy inside the calf. And then I went on to get a second pair because Chad, of all people, was like, you should get another pair of those. If you like them that much, you should get another pair because they're so cheap. And I went on to Horse Lovers and they didn't have any more in my size. And I was like, son of a nutcracker, they're out of my size. Well, I just went back on and they have my size again. Hello.
Are they down that much again?
$29.99. They're originally $395.
They must have been a closeout or something. Hell,
I really, really think they're so comfortable, and they have this grippy inside the calf.
One of
I
the
really
other
like
auditors
them.
Posted that they've been wearing them every day for 10 hours a day for 3 weeks, and she's had no problems with them.
Yeah, I haven't had any problem. I to be fair, I put mine on to ride and then I take them off because I hate walking around in tall boots. It's just not my thing. I've got my little barn shoes that I walk around in. So I'm riding in them and I've ridden in them probably 50 times and no problem. So I really like them. And again, Horse Lovers has them
on. What do they search for when they go?
Actually, they were just right on the homepage there. Let's see. Shop Best Sellers. They're the number one bestseller. I wonder why.
Yeah, I wonder why.
And they're tall boots that are $30. And they're really pretty. I mean, I did not expect much, but I got
zip?
A lot more than I expected. Yes, they zip up the back.
Oh, wow.
There's only one clasp, like one snap to do, as opposed to the bottom snap and the top snap. Just one top snap. Done.
Well, there you go. Check it out. Go buy yours today.
I'm a regular short.
Oh, you know what's funny? They must have caught it, because now when I click on it, it says $29 on the homepage. It says $229.
No. Read again. Read that again.
Oh, now it won't load. Everybody's going there and the page is locked up.
It says $236. That's the amount you save.
Oh.
Retail price $395. You save $158. Let's see here. Add to cart. Let's see what's... Maybe you're right. I don't know. It just said $29.99. So
yeah.
I think they're a great deal.
Well, there's a lot of other deals too. So go check out the Shire's products. The Collegiate Free Reins are on there at a $59 value right now. So I noticed they also have some Wintech saddles and products on sale there as well. Horselovers.com. Okay, this is the point where if you don't want to hear any 9/11 talk, you can bail out. And I understand, you know, there's some people that just can't deal with it.
It's like post-traumatic stress.
Yes.
I mean, we listen to this every single year, and everybody remembers the exact moment they were when they heard about the World Trade Towers falling and just how it just changed. I mean, it just changed life.
How old were you?
Life-changing. I was in my 20s. I was probably 22 or 23, and I was working at the News and Traffic Center, actually, in Atlanta. I was a traffic reporter for a bunch of radio stations, but I mean, I'm sitting right next to news reporters and everything else. So this is a mecca of information that comes
got
in.
Goosebumps thinking about you being in a news center at the time this news came
out. Yeah. And
what
so
was that like?
I know like 10 people, and they're memory of 9/11 is me calling them, because I just I picked up the phone and I called everybody I knew just to make sure everybody's okay. And I mean, I didn't even know anybody in New York that worked in the World Trade Centers, but you just, it just gave you that feeling of wanting to reach out to those that you love and just make sure that everybody's okay.
So what was the feeling? What was it like? Was it just frantic, or was it quiet?
It was frantic. Yeah. I mean, it was frantic, because when you are reporting the news, you do not want to report incorrect news.
Right.
And so, I mean, it was just,
and there was
utter
so much confusion
shock
at the beginning too. Of
yeah.
What it was.
Shock yeah. and confusion on who did it and what happened. I mean, the initial thought was somebody accidentally did this thing. And then, you know, we're all watching it on TV in the news center, gathering as much information as we can. And then boom, the second plane comes in, and then you hear about what's happening in Pennsylvania and what's happening at the Pentagon. And it was just one of those utter crazy mornings where all you wanted to do was go hug those that you love the most. And to me, I mean, it is very hard for me to watch that and relive that, knowing that, I mean, there was just nothing that any of us could do besides sit there and watch it unfold. And all the heroes that helped and saved lives, and all the animals that went in for rescue, and everybody that's suffering now from the heroic events of those years ago, my heart goes out to you, because just those of us that were sitting around doing nothing are affected. I cannot imagine the life that what this day represents to people that were there or lost loved ones. I just can't even imagine. I love you all, and my heart goes out to you. And especially, I know we have a bunch of listeners in New York, and this has got to be a tough day if you live there. All the listeners that we talked about that have birthdays today, I mean, how much that changed that day for them.
Yeah,
forever.
I never thought about that before you said that earlier. It never occurred to me. You know, I was in my Lyme battle had just begun, and we went to the doctors that morning. I remember this clearly. We went to the doctors that morning. We were driving home from the doctors a little after 9 o'clock, right? And we were listening to the radio. I know. People actually listen to the radio in your car.
Well, thank God, because I was doing the reports for
know,
you.
I know.
You better damn well listen.
So we listened to the radio on the way home, and we heard it as a news, you know, they were interrupted to give that news bulletin. And we had our store back then. We had a tack shop, and we had been running the tack shop for years, and our employees were there. And they hadn't heard it, so by the time we got home, we called all the employees in, and we sat in our living room, and for the next 3 hours, watched the TV. And then we sent them all home because they needed to go home and be with their families. And and business stopped in this country for a month. We basically went from selling a lot of stuff in the tack shop to nothing for a month, and that business just stopped. The world kind of, you know, people, I keep, when I see posts now about people saying, you know, I wasn't born yet, or there's people on my Facebook group, you know, my group of friends that were basically under 10 years old, and because it was 18 years ago. And I think about, they never experienced that 3 hours. You know,
that was more than 3 hours.
Yeah, I know, but I meant that
it was like 3 days of just, I mean, crazy. I mean, I remember they canceled World Series games. The world just stopped. I mean, yep. It's that's that country song. Where were you when the world stopped turning?
And it literally stopped. Think about all the people that were traveling in airplanes. Basically, you're in the air and they say, oh, we have to land now. And I wonder what some of those announcements were from the captains, because I'm sure they didn't come on and say, hey, we have to land because this plane could potentially be, you know, hijacked. They just said, oh, you know, we're being ordered to land, or whatever they said. And then all of those people had to try and get home from wherever they were, because there were no flights for a week. I remember that car rental places were sold out of cars, and people were driving across the entire country because they couldn't get home. They just landed at the closest airport. And can you imagine being an air traffic controller during that time? Oh, my God. I can't even imagine.
there's
was Chad
every
a pilot
angle of it
then?
Is tremendous. Yeah, yeah. So he was deployed at that time.
He
flew F-16s around New York.
Oh, he did? So he was in the country. He wasn't overseas.
No, he was here. In pilot training, he was an instructor pilot at that time. And so he was, I don't know how much I'm supposed to say, but he basically flew F-16s around New York waiting for another person to come. And then the next assignment that he had was he went to George Bush's ranch, and they had F-16s, and they had guys that sat there ready, and they sit in these trailers and they just wait to scramble. And so that's what he did. Was he didn't go off to Afghanistan or Iraq or Iran, anywhere overseas. He was here in our country.
Those planes we saw flying over New York, where he was in one of them, probably.
Yep. So, I mean, it changed the world. So,
yeah. Well, you're going to hear next is something that I put together back in 2012 on 9/11. And it was a year after we started this show. So it was within the first year of starting this show. And what we did was we got a whole bunch of horse people, and we had this conversation that Jamie and I just had, because everybody has their story of where they were. So we had this conversation with a number of horse people. Some you'll recognize, even new listeners will recognize. They're still coming on our shows all these years later. So we want to play this for you. If you'd like to listen to it, please do. If you've heard it before, you know, we understand if you bail out at this point. It's about an hour long. I've added some music and some sound. It's very poignant. It was tough to do this one, by the way. It was probably one of the toughest episodes I ever put together. It was tough editing-wise. It was tough emotionally. It was just tough. But we're proud of it. It came out as good as it was going to come out for the topic at hand. So we'll be back tomorrow. Mary will be here with Jennifer doing some training. And then Friday, are you going to be here or not? You going to that open house thing, or are you going to be here?
The good news is the open house is exactly the same on Saturday as it is Friday. So I'm going to the open house for the BLM Paul's Valley on Saturday morning, and I'll come back
for this.
He's coming.
Oh,
he's like, okay.
He'll have your credit cards, your checkbook. He'll have everything.
Trailer, nothing.
Going in the sedan to this one.
Again, this is where the Mustangs, the long-term holding is for the Mustangs. So these Mustangs are mostly purchasable, or they're waiting to be shipped across the country. And so they're doing an open house. So I thought, what a better time to go check it out when they're showing everything. And they're going to be doing some demonstrations with some Mustang trainers. So I'm excited to go.
This is going to kill you. This is going to be bad.
I wonder if I could fit a weenling in the back of our Volkswagen.
Well, they put minis in the back of, SUVs and stuff.
You're not helping. You're not helping.
All right. So we'll be back for Really Bad Ads on Friday. Tammy's going to come on Friday from Road to the Horse and help us pick the winner for the Road to the Horse tickets. And then we'll be announcing new prizes for Really Bad Ads on Friday as well. So you still have until Friday to win the Road to the Horse tickets by getting a Really Bad Ad in to Jennifer at horseradionetwork.com. And now our tribute to 9/11. I am Glenn the Geek from Ocala, Florida, and you're listening to a special commercial-free episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for September 11th, 2012, episode 485. 11 years ago today, at this very hour, an event happened that changed the United States and the world. This special episode of Horses in the Morning honors those that died that day. Where were you on 9/11? We have heard from listeners and other horse people from around the country about their experiences and where they were on 9/11. We will share those stories with you today. Horse people are very compassionate people, and we will never forget the people that died that day and those that sacrificed their lives for others. May God bless them and their families.
Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country.
I was lying in bed. All of a sudden, I heard what sounded like a plane or something coming extremely low, and then we just heard this shattering explosion. I ran up to the roof and confronted by this horror. There's a gaping hole. I can see the South Face, and there are flames. There are papers flying out of the windows, black flames. There are flames coming out of multiple floors.
Tomorrow, all the things were gone. I'd work for all
things
my life.
Things are really in chaos.
And I had to start again. Just my children and my
tons of people were running down Fulton Street.
Thank my lucky stars to be living here.
The World Trade Center is smoking.
Because the flag still stands for freedom.
Coming out of all sides.
And they can't take that away.
It's a symbol, I think, of our strength. But we are the United States of America.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. 'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land.
looked out my window to see what was going on, and the Second World Trade Center just went into flames from 1 minute to the next.
I was actually talking to my brother on the phone about what happened. I was on my roof, and I saw something from where I am. I really can't see what it is. I saw something go into the other building, because from where I am, I could see the World Trade Center.
The smoke coming out of the top of the World Trade Center, both buildings now.
From the lakes of Minnesota.
Really horrifying.
To the hills.
We're just blocked away from the World Trade Center.
Across the plains of Texas.
Smoke and debris.
From sea to shining sea.
Building literally began to collapse.
From Detroit down.
This story is not over yet.
And New York to LA. Well, there's pride in every American heart. And it's time we stand and say.
Just a moment ago, we saw a huge amount of flames.
That I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
We don't know what's gonna happen next.
And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land.
Smoke was just billowing in the air.
God bless the USA.
Before us, there was debris falling, I'd say, at least three-quarters the height of the building.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Hi, I'm with Lori from Arkansas. Now, Lori, you were in a little bit different place than the rest of us. Tell us about your experience and where you were on 9/11 when you heard the news.
Well, interestingly, on 9/11, I was living in the Middle East in a city called Erbid, in Jordan, and had been there for, I don't know, I guess for about a year, and things were peaceful and quite, you know, typical. I was out going to the market. We were living very simple. It didn't have TVs. Many people there don't, and I had just left my home and was walking into the market, and some of the neighborhood kids were very excited and kind of running around, a little scared, and one of them stopped and told my son, who was then in first grade, and I, that America had just been bombed, and they continued running home. There was quite a bit of excitement in the streets and fear. You sensed fear, and I went into the little market by our house where a lot of people went and watched television, and we all were kind of gathered around. There were, you know, probably a dozen people from the streets that came into the store to watch, and the Twin Towers were there smoldering, and their news footage was rolling, and it was incredibly surreal to be in the Middle East and see that happening. No part of it felt like it could be possible or that it could be real. I can remember standing there watching that and just feeling completely bewildered and having a sense that I needed to go home.
What was the atmosphere with the locals in Jordan?
The locals there, definitely, my feeling was that they were very fearful. There was a great sense of fear as to what the repercussions could mean for them. There were things in the news, you know, pointing in the direction of the Middle East.
Right.
I mean, immediately. So, and we all kind of know what's going on in the world and how things kind of tend to play out. And there just was this sense of, oh my God, something bad's going to happen.
Now, were you inclined immediately after that to want to go home, or did you stay in Jordan?
I started the procedures for going home, very soon after that. It took a while. It wasn't a case of just hopping on the plane and going. But yes, I did feel the need to get home. It was quite disconcerting to have something as tremendously impactive as that occur and to be outside of your country.
One of the things I don't think I realized until we started doing the interviews for this is, you know, is how it was carried live throughout the world. Here you are in a little shop in Jordan watching on a TV set, probably CNN or network like that, and you were watching it live.
Right.
I mean, that's not right. Something you even think about living here in the United States. You know, we all knew we were all watching it live, but you didn't think about the rest of the world watching it live as well, including the Middle East.
Right. And the impact on, you know, your everyday person, people that I was around day to day were people just like me. They just happened to be in another country, people who were trying to get groceries and what's for dinner tonight and you know, how to pay the light bill. And just because they were happened to be in Jordan, that was their thoughts and feelings like any other average person and mine. And, you know, everything kind of came to a screaming halt that day with smoke billowing out of those Twin Towers.
Well, thank you so much, Laurie, for telling your story, and what an amazing story and what an amazing place to be at, and something I'm sure, like the rest of us, you'll never forget.
Exactly, that's for sure.
My name is Leslie Wiley. I'm the managing editor of HorseNation.com and a guest on Horses in the Morning each Monday. Where was I on 9/11? After sitting glued to the television with my college roommate all morning, I'd torn myself away to drive out to the barn to meet a reporter and photographer from our local newspaper who'd come out to do a story about me. I'd won the Pony Club National Dressage Championships a few weeks before, and I guess they thought it would be a good hometown girl, done good feature. What would have ordinarily been a fun brag session, however, on that particular day felt completely hollow. Everyone involved, I think, was going through the motions. The reporter asking me questions and pretending to be interested in my answers. The photographer asking me to paste a forced smile on my face. And me feeling totally ridiculous as I recounted the story of winning the championships, a victory that now seemed so trivial and meaningless in light of what was happening in New York City. It's a feeling that has haunted me over the years. Every time I hear a news story about starving children or a natural disaster or a war, this guilt over how much time and energy I invest in equestrian pursuits when there's so much suffering in the world. How can we justify our indulgence and pleasure when we're surrounded by so much pain? And I still don't have an answer. I just have to believe somehow that what I'm doing does have intrinsic value, that happiness in whatever shape it takes has meaning, that happiness is a gift we are meant to accept, that we enjoy our lives because that's what God wants. Ultimately, I think the best way to honor those who lost their lives on 9/11 is to continue living our own lives to the best of our ability, following our dreams, lifting up those around us, and seizing every moment of every day.
I'm here with Chris from Equestrian Collections to tell her story about where she was when she heard the news on 9/11. Chris, where were you?
I was actually at home, which I normally wouldn't be at that time. We'd spent the evening before we'd gone in to Washington to the Kennedy Center. I remember it was a two-part performance. One part was on the 10th, and the next part we had tickets to go back the day later. On the 11th, and we were coming back, and the route takes us right past the Pentagon, and it was all lit up, looks absolutely wonderful, and my husband and I had a little chat about, you know, what an amazing building it is, and he'd worked in the Pentagon, and knew a lot of people from there, so we were just kind of chatting on, and off we went home. So it was late. It was gone midnight when we got in, so we were a little bit late. And I was just about to leave the house when the phone rang, and it was my brother down in Florida. And he said he'd just heard from my brother in London. The news was breaking there, I guess. And he said, get on to the TV, put CNN on and you know, see what's happening. Something's awful. It looks as though a plane has hit one of the towers at the World Trade Center. And at this point, obviously, we kind of just we put it on. Must have been what, a little before 9 o'clock, 8:45, something like that. And we were standing there, like everybody else, somewhat dismayed and shocked, looking at it and going, "Oh my goodness, all those people!" And then suddenly, of course, just after 9 o'clock, I think the other plane went into the second tower, and we realized it wasn't just something that was horribly wrong. It was something way beyond, I think, any, you know, anything that anybody had thought possible in the United States. So with that, I can remember, you know, saying, well, first thing, call the office. I knew people would be in there to say, go home, because obviously, you know, selling equestrian attire and things on a day like that just didn't make any sense. And I wanted everyone home. We didn't know what was going to happen next. We were so close to Washington, D.C. We were 24 miles away as the crow flies from the White House, where my home was, and also where my the office part of Equestrian Collections was. So, you know, we made that call. I think everybody obviously left right away, and you know, the next thing that we knew was I think President Bush came on, and then right after that we heard of the Flight 77 going into the Pentagon. And, you know, being around here, we all know people who work there, or we have staff who had relatives working in there, spouses working in there. So obviously that was, you know, you just felt the day couldn't get any worse than it was. And of course it did get worse and worse, but you know, that's kind of where we were, feeling extremely vulnerable, with, you know, family members calling from all over the country wanting to know whether we were okay, people from England calling, since I'm from England, wanting to know what was happening, were we all right, because we seemed awfully close to what some of what was happening. So
we were in a bunch of same situation, because we had the horse stuff company then, and the employees were sitting there watching the TV. We're all watching it together. One of the things that we haven't touched on yet in this show is how it affected the country. We really had no orders, and I think this was pretty much true for almost any kind of business. Mm. The orders just died for weeks. People.
Yes.
The same with you?
Yes. People just. Obviously, you've got everything that you need, and I think it realigned what was important to everybody. It's obviously your livelihood is important to you, but I think everyone spent a lot of time checking in on their families and checking in, you know, trying to figure out what was going to happen to horses, or people stranded with horses in strange places, and lots of people trying to get back into the United States when all the planes were grounded. A lot of them coming back where they had people taking care of their farms while they were on vacation. And, you know, that was the kind of thing that people were getting very concerned about. People that were stuck and not where they wanted to be, and having to, you know, come across country in cars, or just being stuck for, you know, it seemed to be weeks on end. I'm sure it wasn't quite that, but trying to get back here was very, very difficult, especially for people who have animals and all of that. So we heard a lot of that, of those stories at the time. But yeah, it took a long time before business kind of got back to normal, if we ever got back to normal, and I don't think we really ever have, but you know, you pick up and you go on. And I think that was the other thing, was just a huge amount of inspiration that we all got from watching the people that did go in and help, and did go and risk their lives as well, and lost their lives going in to save other people. You know, and then hearing the personal stories, of, especially around here, people who had lost relatives in the Pentagon, So we around here in the Washington D.C. Northern Virginia area, I think we've felt it was very, very, very close to home for us.
That was Jealous of the Angels by Jen Bostick. You can find all of her music at jbmusicfun.com. We received an email from somebody who is a friend of the Horse Radio Network who said that she could not get on because it would be too emotional to tell this story in person, and she asked that I read her email to you. This is from Karen. I grew up just outside the city, the other side of the TZ Bridge. My grandmother's Italian immigrant parents raised their family in New York City. My mother took the train into the city as a young girl. I often went to the city as a teenager. I could see the Empire State Building from my house on a clear day. The town I grew up in was home to many of the New York's finest, both police and firefighters. There is no place on earth like the Big Apple. It's part of me. I was at the office in Versailles, Kentucky, the day the towers came down, and my younger brother was working in Washington just around the corner from the Pentagon. I spent the morning alternately watching the devastation unfolding on TV and talking to my frantic parents and sister-in-law on the phone while trying to find out if my brother was alive. The cell service in D.C. was so disrupted, it was hours before he was able to connect with his wife. My husband was traveling internationally that day. He was on the phone trying to decipher what was going on. It was surreal watching the towers fall. I remember the event unfold on the small TV we had in the break room. Everybody was glued to the TV. All work came to a halt. The phones even stopped ringing. The room was silent. As the first tower began to fall, I slid down the wall I was leaning against and ended up sitting on the floor. Then the second tower came down. I didn't want to watch, but at the same time, I couldn't look away. I was just in total shock. How could this be happening? All of those people, not just in the towers, but the buildings surrounding them, all the firefighters and the New York Police Department. It was so hard to explain to the people in the room who had never been there, never seen that area on a busy weekday morning, just how catastrophic this event was. It was horrendous and it was real, and we were seeing it unfold in front of us. The images are forever burned into my memory. To me, the New York skyline will never be the same. The missing towers will forever be a testament to all those who lost their lives and gave their lives that day. Karen from Kentucky Performance Products in Versailles, Kentucky.
My name is Amanda Wright, and I currently live in Manhattan, but at the time I lived in Medicine Lodge, Kansas. And actually, it's kind of funny because I was driving my Thunderbird out to our farm to feed my horse in the morning before school when it came on the radio. And the radio station that I usually listen to often played pranks of that sort of nature. Well, not that nature, but they were always doing some sort of shenanigans. And when I heard it, I just thought, oh, that's just really distasteful. Like, before they'd done a Godzilla attack on Tokyo and had played it out like it was very realistic and stuff. And so, you know, I got out of the car, I left it running and left the door open and was petting in my horse and feeding her in the morning and making sure she had clean water and everything. And I got back in the car and I was driving to school because I was 17 at the time. And it was my senior year and they just kept going and going. And I was just like, guys, it's not funny, please just stop, you know. And I actually ended up turning the radio off. It was only that when I got to school that I went into my first class and every classroom had all their TVs on tuned to the same news station. And honestly, that's when my world changed forever, even though it was thousands of miles away. I did have friends in the area and, you know, after speaking to them later that day, they, you know, one girl especially said she was, even though she was in New Jersey, she could, she had family in the area, you know, they saw it. It was quite devastating for everyone. And, you know, that's the way that we lived for the next month or over a month. And just every day I went to school, we didn't do anything but watch the news. Everything was absolutely put on a standstill. And for a graduation present, my family had planned a road trip to Virginia. And we made a site, we had planned to make a site stop in Washington, but we actually have photographs of the Pentagon with all the damage in it. And so it just sort of, it really struck home. It really changed a lot of things because we had already made these plans. We were already going to see these things, and now it just added a whole new aspect to it. And, you know, my sister was going on a missionary trip, but she had to go to New York, actually, to interview with the group. And, you know, her interview was in October. And so she actually got pictures of Ground Zero. She got to see it, and she said that all of the businesses were closed, and the smell of burning plastic and rotting human flesh was so completely overpowering that it was just unimaginable. And you could smell it for at least a 6-block radius. It was just all-consuming. And so it really drove home how sad it really all was, how real it really all was. I know so many people watched it on the news, but my family actually got to experience it in ways that a lot of people other didn't, and it just is sad. It's devastating. And I pray to God, I hope, that nothing like this ever happens again. And all of my hopes and wishes go out to the family members who lost their loved ones in that horrible, horrible attack. And I hope today that they are all strong and happy and healthy and moving on with their lives.
Well, we have Joseph here from Equity Manufacturing, and thank you so much for calling in today to talk to us about where you were on 9/11. First question is, where in the country were you on 9/11?
Actually, Glenn, at that particular time, I was over in Portugal.
Oh, okay. Well, tell us how you heard, where were you when you heard the news?
Well, you know, it's a funny deal because 9/11, most of the time when I talk to you, I'm very upbeat, and to this day, I can still barely talk about 9/11 without profound sadness and a tremendous emotion. It was one of the happiest moments of my life was those particular days. I'd been married for a number of years, and my wife had given me a beautiful black Andalusian stallion, and we decided that one of the ways to get familiar with the horse was actually to do what Jamie did, which is to go over to Spain and Alcaina, or Spain in the Andalusian region, and ride horses. And we had gone to a tourist type training location, and I had had my first ride of the day, and I was sitting reading a book outside of the little room that we'd rented, and somebody came running over to me and said that a plane had crashed into a building in New York. And, you know, being a pilot, I thought, oh, some wayward 172 had strayed and flown into a building. And I go into the room where they have the live CNN feed. And I, like everybody probably, you're just watching with absolute horror, fascination. I don't know how to describe it, as the smoke is billowing from the first building and nobody knows what's going on. And I don't know what it was like in the U.S. at that particular time. And I don't know what the news feeds were, but when you're in a foreign country and you're watching this, it felt incredibly vulnerable, which you just didn't have a sense that you really had any idea what was going on. And I remember watching this thing and then the second plane hitting and the disbelief that I felt at watching this and the quiet that was in the room, as none of us that are there quite knew how to comprehend what we were looking at. And then the building fell. And the thought of the thousands of people that were just instantaneously killed was incredibly profound. Still is. And after that was over, I remember walking around in Lisbon or other places, and Portuguese people, recognizing that I was an American, would walk up and express their condolences for the country, for us as citizens of the country, that something so incredible would affect us. And it was the beginning and it was the end, I think, of this broad-based acceptance and admiration of America. I at that particular time when I went to the airport, there was no way to get out of Portugal. The flights had all been canceled. You know, when I went into Portugal, there was so much happiness at the airport. And when I left, it was machine guns and it was security and it was fear. And, you know, it never recovered. It's never been the same in the times that I've been there since. I've had much, much different conversations with people in foreign countries. And so it's really, it was one of those moments that I know people have them about Kennedy and other things, where were you? But in my life, there's never been anything that has affected me as powerfully as that moment when the building fell.
Well, Joseph, you had a different perspective because you were in a foreign country. You were in Portugal. What was the attitude and was the shock as great with the Portuguese people as it was with us here?
Oh, well, I wasn't over here, but I can tell you everybody was stunned. It was absolutely because, you know, it's hard to recall just how loved the USA was at that time. Everything was growing. The political, situation was different. And so the feeling for Americans was really, really great. And when it happened, it was more just disbelief of why would somebody attack America? It was
if a lot of them had traveled to the United States as tourists, one of the places they would have gone would have been New York. They would have seen those stars. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I, once again, I wasn't over there. I couldn't call my wife. I couldn't get hold of anybody. The phone lines were clogged, and you didn't know whether it was the beginning of a war. I just can't describe how incredibly vulnerable and far away from my wife and home and no way to get back. You know, I remember even calling to cruise ships, trying to find some way to get back to the U.S. It was absolutely amazing.
Well, I'm here with Lisa from Chicago. Now, Lisa, where were you at 9/11 and when you heard the news?
Well, Glenn, I was at home. I mean, I got a phone call from my sister that woke me up, and you know, I turned on the TV and I just started watching. And at that point, you know, the first tower had been hit, but you know, they were still standing. And you know, I was I live on Chicago's far north side. And actually, back then, we lived in Evanston, which is the suburb immediately to the north of Chicago. But my partner, he works downtown in a skyscraper downtown Chicago. And so, you know, as all of this was unfolding and nobody knew what was going on and all that, I mean, it just was really kind of nerve-wracking because he works not too far from the Sears Tower, which is, you know, could be a big target. We just didn't know about that. And then my dad and stepmom were actually traveling, had flown out of state, and were traveling during that time. And they ended up having to, you know, get a rental car. And thankfully, they thought ahead because, you know, and went ahead and did that because had they waited, they might not have been able, they might have been stuck for weeks out of state and away from home. So, you know, just watching on the TV and just being so like sick to my stomach, you know, and just thinking about all the people affected and all the parents, you know, all the kids whose parents were working in those buildings. And my, you know, I have family members who, you know, are both in the, you know, police and firefighters and relatives who are, you know, so I know what that's like when your family members are going into dangerous situations. So there was just so many different, you know, different levels that, you know, even though I wasn't there, I just felt for all the people who were experiencing that.
Well, I have on that note, speaking of the kids, I have a tribute to the victims of 9/11. This is by Riley Roth. It's called Always in My Memory. And she was 2 when her dad died on 9/11 in New York. And now she sings. Oh. And I think she's like 10, I believe, when she sang this. And all the proceeds for this song are going to charities to help the children of 9/11. So let's take a listen to that.
Thank you. gone by. Never said too much about it, and I've always wondered why. Who were those men smiling in that shot? I heard stories about the day the towers crashed and the fire they fought. My father was there that sad, sad day, and I never got to shake his hand or say goodbye. Eye when he began to say, all these men had died together on this day. They did their call of duty as they helped save other lives.
I'm here with Tammy from the Western Radio Show, who has a little bit of a different perspective on where were you, Tammy, on 9/11 when you heard the news?
Where was I? I actually was in Texas, Glenn. I had actually came over from Perth, Western Australia in 1999. I went back to Perth for a little bit to visit, and I was coming back in 2000. So I'd really only been back in Texas about 12 months when 9/11 happened. And I was just kind of training cutting horses out at Lindy Birch's at Oxbow Ranch. And for those in the cutting industry in the Western world, they know how strict Lindy's equestrian camp is. And there was nothing but you had to work. There was no anything else, you know. So I remember hearing, I don't know if I heard it in the radio. We normally keep the radio on in the indoor arena. And I went up to the apartment above the barn, and we turned the TV on, and I remember thinking, we should not be doing this. This is so against our work ethic. We work and we don't, you know, this is just against everything we're supposed to do. And although I'm Australian and I hadn't really been in Texas that long, I just remember sitting there, and we tied the horses up, and we thought, you know, we couldn't work. It wasn't important to us right at that time. So we just kind of just put everything on hold for the day and went up and just gathered around the TV in the barn there and just
watched it unfold, and we were watching after the first hit on the first tower, and remembered, you know, the second one, and I just thought, this is crazy, and I was thinking everything that was going to come after this, and I remember sitting there at the TV thinking, I'm going to look back on this day, and this day is going to be, you know, those days that's just going to stick in history. This is going to be one of those monumental days that no one ever forgets. And I guess even on the days that you're watching and you realize that and you're thinking that, you still don't remember the extent of how momentous that really is. But even though I am not American, you know, I almost think of myself as being American, because that's how wounded I felt and that's how hurt I felt by watching something like that. Because, you know, it's being American is one thing, but I think this was a blatant attack against humanity. This was just an act that one human being doesn't do to another. And I think, for me, coming from Australia, we have different beliefs, we have different religion, we have a different way of looking at life, but the way I look at life, it doesn't matter what perspective you have. It doesn't matter what you believe in. It doesn't matter what you think. It's about respect. It's about respecting each other. It's about respecting life. And it's just about being kind to one another. And that was everything against that. So I think coming and being an Australian and looking at that day, it was so... unhumanitarian, if that's a word. It was such an attack on your ethics as a person, you know. So that's probably the more of the perspective that I had at that time, being Australian. In, you know, I remember my mother called me straight away, and she didn't,
because it was late at night in Australia.
Yeah, she did. She called me, and she had no geographical knowledge of where they were in regard to Texas. And she's like, "Oh my gosh, are you okay?" I said, "Yeah, really. You know, it's a long way from where I'm at here in Texas." But she was very devastated. So news definitely traveled fast. So yeah, it was. It definitely got over there quick, and my brother had called me and chatted to me a little bit about it. They were pretty up to date of everything that had gone on, but yes, it was really hard for them over there without the knowledge of the states that I had over here. You know, when something like that happens, other things nothing's really important anymore. Right. How do you go on? How do you, the horse that has to be loped, you know, is to win the futurity is not important when. And it's hard for me, Glenn, because even, you know, not related to 911, but my father was killed by a drunk driver when I was 4 or 5 years old. And I can sit there, and if I'm driving for lunch and I see an ambulance go by, it gives me this sick pit in my stomach. And I look at that and I think, I know how much my life was changed by that one death, by my father dying when I was 4 or 5 years old. It's changed my life. I wouldn't be in Texas if he hadn't been killed by that person. I would be in Australia. My life would be so dramatically different. I would hate to even think. And I still consider myself very blessed for the life I have now, but it would be very different. So I look at those people that have lost those loved ones, either in a car accident that I'm seeing it unfold between my eyes, or when 911 happened, and I think, look at all those hundreds of thousands of people, and look at all the lives that would be changed in the way that my life was changed. And I think that's how I relate to it the most, and that's what hurts me the most, because I understand the pain of losing a loved one, and I see and I know firsthand the way that that can change someone's life. And I look at those people and I'm just sorry. You know, I'm sorry you have to endure those changes in your life, and not everyone has the strength to get through it in the best possible way, and I am sorry for that, you know, and that's probably the way I relate to it.
When the feeling's gone, whoa,
I live in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. But 9/11, I was at work. Somebody heard on the radio there was an airplane heading for the tower. And everybody stopped it and said, what? This doesn't happen in this country. But it did. And somebody had a computer with a TV screen or a little TV screen. And we stood there and watched it over and over and over and like, wow, who ever heard of such a thing? Later that day, I got a phone call from my daughter-in-law who said that her sister, who works in the Pentagon, was okay. But she and her secretary had just left her office when the plane hit, and her office was gone. Even stranger was the fact that her secretary's brother was in the North Tower and made it out. I got a call from my stepdaughter who said, we're okay. I was on my way to work, and this plane came and wiped out the Pentagon a block and a half from where I was. I went home. That's what happened that day with us.
I'm here with Dr. Tucker of the Equine Practice. And Dr. Tucker, where were you on 9/11 when you heard the news?
I had just flown in the day before into Newark Airport, and I was on the starboard side of the plane, and I looked out on the crystal clear blue skies of the autumn day, and I saw the World Trade Centers standing tall, and I said, yep, I'm back in New York. And it was quite a thrill, and to land there and work all day the day before the tragedy was just classic for New York. It was just an autumn day. And it brought back so many childhood memories. And that night, I made my way over to New London, Connecticut, where I spent the night, and the next morning hopped on the ferry that took me across Long Island Sound. And that's where I was, somewhere on Long Island Sound, when this occurred, but I didn't know anything about it until my wife called me, and I was driving through the Hamptons when she said a plane had hit the towers. And I was on my way to several farms that day in the Hamptons of New York. And the first place I went to, everybody was in the office looking at the TV. And I just couldn't believe what I saw. It was surreal. And it was there that I saw the first tower collapse. And everybody was just silent and unsure what was happening. It was really real. And I pretty much figured that I wasn't going to be able to do any work at that barn. And they said, just go. And it's really weird because when you travel all over the country and you're so set on a schedule to go from one farm to the next to get work done, that's the mode that you're in. And it hadn't hit me yet. And so I went to the next farm. And if anybody knows, has been to the Hamptons, there's a farm called Two Trees, which is just a huge place. And I'll never forget walking into the barn, and this is a world-class equestrian who had his horses there, and they were still in the cross ties, and it was like a ghost town. There's nobody there. And so I hunted around and found a small outbuilding where everybody had gone, all the grooms, the trainers, everybody, and they're in watching, and I saw the second tower collapse, and it started to hit home, and I'm getting goosebumps just now just thinking about it. And I wondered how I was going to get off of Long Island because the only way west is through New York City, which I thought was under invasion at the time. So I made my way back to the ferry, and the ferry was clear. I thought everybody was going to be evacuating Long Island. I didn't know what to think. But I got on the ferry, and I got back into Connecticut, and I didn't know where to go. And I wandered around, and next thing you knew, I was in Saratoga Springs at the Holiday Inn, where I sat at the end of the bed and stared at the TV all night, just replaying and watching this thing. I figured I had like 70 horses that I could work on the next day at Saratoga Springs. They would have no problems with me working there. But I was just devastated. On top of this, I needed to get home, and I couldn't because I had a rental car, and it was going to cost me over $4,000 to return it to Florida. And the next day, a full-page ad in USA Today said, you guys need to be home. And budget pretty much forgave anybody. They said, just drive wherever you need to be with your family, and we won't charge you any extra. So I ended up driving south down I-81, and I'm in Virginia, and I'm still numb. I'm still in disbelief. When a client from Florida called and says, hey, can you do my two horses? I said, well, yeah. She said, but wait a minute. There's a catch.
My horse is now in Winchester, Virginia. And I just started laughing. And I said, oh, I can be there in 30 minutes. Who would have thought? But it was that little break that I needed just to come back to reality and say, oh my gosh, this is devastating. And I need, I can't even put into words what was going on. And for the next year, I heard story after story of people who had either been at the trade centers, saw it happen, looked out the window and had it happen, knew people who had died in there that they had worked with, but they had left a year earlier to become horse trainers. And the devastation of these people's minds for over a year was just indescribable. And even to today, when you think about the tragedy that occurred, and not just there, but every time I go through Pennsylvania and every time I pass the Pentagon in my travels, I just think of this day and how it was a turning point for all of us. It didn't matter if we like horses or not, or where we sit on the political aisle. It was just, it strengthened our resolve to stand for freedom. And that's where I am. And that's why I still travel all over the country, embracing the principles of America. Because those people who died, I'm not going to let them die in vain. I'm going to go out there and continue the American spirit because of them.
Well, hi, Reese from the Dressage Radio Show. Thank you so much for joining us today. Hey, Reese, where were you on 9/11 when you heard the news?
Well, Glenn, I was actually in the barn. I was in the barn with my mom, who, you know, I'm really close to my mom, and we were actually doing stalls and getting ready. I was getting ready to ride. I was literally, like, going to put a bridle on my horse. And my mom always complained to me about the radio station that I chose. I don't know if that's other people's problems in the barn, but my mom likes classical, and I didn't like classical. So she literally was just fussing with me about the radio show, the program I was listening to, and I was going to change the radio station, and I was literally at the radio when I heard the news. And, you know, I was in there, my mom was in there, and actually our plumber, Bill, was in there. And we literally all stopped and just, we didn't know what to do. We just stopped and, yeah, just listened to the radio. And at that point, I decided that we should probably go in the house and turn on the radio and or turn on the TV. And we did. I unpacked my horse quickly, and Mom, Bill, and I all walked into the house, and we just sat there stunned and just really didn't know what to do. And I called Travis, who is my now husband. At the time, we were dating, and he was in Seattle. And so I knew he wasn't up. So I called him, and his roommate that I'm close to picked up the phone, and I said, hey, you need to wake everybody up and listen, you know, look at the radio, you know, look at the TV or the radio. So it was a morning that we all just kind of sat there, and we sat there for, oh gosh, I don't even remember, 2 or 3 hours. And finally, you know, I got up, and I don't think I rode any horses that day. I think just like everyone else, we were all just stunned. And then I remember I had to do a clinic in St. Louis that weekend coming up, and I had to fly. And they called me and they said, you know, what do you want to do? Do you want to come do the clinic? And it was a short flight. It was from Lexington to St. Louis. And I said, you know what? I'm going to go. I said, you know, I can't stay home. I don't really want to drive 7 hours to the clinic. So I'm going to fly. And I did. I flew that weekend. And I think I was on the plane with one other person. In the clinic, they were so thankful that I came. And one of my riders said, you know, you were so brave to get on the plane. And I think my response to her was, life has to go back to normal. You know, we can't let this kind of change our, I mean, it is going to change our lives, but we need to continue for all the people that were lost.
I am here with Julie Broadway, who was living in North Carolina at the time. Julie, what do you remember about 9/11, and where were you when you heard the news?
Well, Glenn, it's an interesting story. I had gone to a conference in Quebec City. I had traveled up a couple of days before the conference actually began. At the time, my fiance had gone with me, and he had just flown back to Raleigh, North Carolina, as the conference was beginning. The first day of the conference, we were attending a number of sessions, and word was starting to trickle out that something was happening in New York. And the conference organizers decided that they wanted to keep everyone well informed of what the events were. And so they actually used the large screens they had set up in the main convention space to televise all of the news. And we were, it was surreal because we were actually watching the towers burn, and we were watching as things were unfolding on this large screen. It looked like a movie, a terror movie. And people were talking amongst themselves. People were trying very hard to contact family to find out if they were okay, to let them know that we were okay in Quebec City. And just a lot of emotion and anxiety. Everyone was very concerned about what was going on back home and how they were going to get home. And that was the second part of the equation. Once the reality of the situation kind of sunk in and we began to accept the events that we were seeing on this huge screen, we all began to think, now what? And immediately people started trying to get a flight home, and of course they couldn't do that. And they tried to rent a car, and they had closed the borders between Canada and the U.S. at the time. And so they couldn't rent a car to get home. And everyone was just anxious about how they were going to get back to their loved ones. It was very emotional for everybody that was there. And a lot of people tried a lot of different avenues to get home. And in my particular case, I was stuck there for a couple of extra days. And finally, one of the companies that was based in Raleigh, North Carolina, chartered a bus. And the bus drove from North Carolina all the way to Quebec City.
Wow.
And they loaded everybody in the bus that they could hold that was anywhere on the route between there and North Carolina and put us all on the bus. It was a long journey home. And they stopped frequently and let people off the bus at just little intersections where their family could come and pick them up wherever they could find along the route. My thoughts are with everyone as we remember this big event.
Thank you for listening, and let's never forget.